geographical balance to the ticket. The contrast with the Republican ticket could be damaging. But by phone the next morning, Truman asked Barkley why he had never told him he wanted to be vice president. "I didn't know you wanted the nomination," Truman said.
"Mr. President, you do not know it yet," Barkley answered.
"Well, if I had known you wanted it, I certainly would have been agreeable," Truman said, which, though hardly a ringing confirmation, was sufficient for both to consider the decision settled. And almost immediately afterward in Philadelphia, McGrath told reporters that if the convention saw fit to nominate Senator Barkley for vice president, the president would be most happy. Barkley, who had been available as a vice presidential choice at every convention since 1928, told friends that if the nomination were to be his, he wanted it quickly.
"I don't want it passed around so long it is like cold biscuit."
As it was, Truman showed more distress over the Douglas refusal than enthusiasm over Barkley. To his staff, he seemed oddly, almost irresponsibly disinterested in the whole matter. He, if anyone, should have appreciated the potential importance of the decision. Yet there was no sign of thoughtful deliberation on his part.
"Talking about the vice presidency," wrote Eben Ayers, "the president said he never did care much who was nominated with him."
Excitement over Barkley was quickly eclipsed as a floor fight broke out over civil rights. A Negro alternate from St. Louis makes a minority report suggesting the unseating of the Mississippi delegation, Truman recorded, as he watched the drama unfold on the tiny black-and-white screen. "Vaughn is his name. He's overruled. Then Congressman Dawson of Chicago, another Negro, makes an excellent talk on civil rights. These two colored men are the only speakers to date who seem to be for me wholeheartedly." The following day, Wednesday, July 14th, the day scheduled for Truman's nomination and acceptance speech, the uproar over civil rights turned angry, as a vehement ADA faction headed by Mayor Hubert Humphrey demanded a stronger civil rights plank in the party platform. The existing plank was substantially what it had been in the 1944 platform, mild and ambiguous enough to mollify the Southern delegations, and the wording had been agreed to at the White House, Truman and his advisers having decided now was no time to alienate the Southerners. Humphrey was warned he would split the party and ruin his own career if he persisted. But Humphrey and his forces held out for a plank that would emphatically endorse Truman's own civil rights program, item by item. Anti-poll tax and anti-lynching legislation, fair employment laws, an end to segregation in the armed services. In bitter, heated sessions of the platform committee on the top floor of the Bellevue Stratford, Humphrey charged that the administration plank was a sellout to states' rights over human rights. When the committee approved the moderate plank, the Humphrey forces took the fight to the convention floor. "We were inherently stronger than Truman's followers had believed," remembered one of them, Paul Douglas, a candidate for the Senate in Illinois. As the majority report of the platform committee was being read before the convention, and Humphrey sat near the rostrum, waiting his turn to speak, Boss Ed Flynn beckoned Humphrey to show him the minority report, and having looked it over, Flynn said,
"Young man, that's just what this party needs."
Unlike Jake Arvey and Frank Haig, Flynn had thought the whole Eisenhower idea silly, and that those who imagined otherwise were hacks and amateurs, blind to his own favorite political maxim, "Never confuse wishes with facts." There was no question that Harry Truman would be nominated, Flynn had been saying.
and he wanted to see Harry Truman win. Humphrey stepped to the podium, his face shining. The audience suddenly hushed. He spoke less than 10 minutes, and he made history. It was time for the Democratic Party to move forward. "There are those who say to you, we are rushing this issue of civil rights. I say we are 172 years late. The time has arrived for the Democratic Party to get out of the shadow of states' rights and walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights." As the convention roared its approval, the California and Illinois delegations marched into the aisles. Others followed, joined by a 40-piece band led by James C. Petrillo, head of the American Federation of Musicians, while here and there glum, silent Southern delegations kept their seats. At the podium, Sam Rayburn of Texas, permanent chairman of the convention, looked down disapprovingly, fearing a Southern walkout would destroy whatever slim chance Truman might have in November and devastate the party, possibly forever. Rayburn tried to stall a vote, but when it came, the Humphrey forces won a resounding victory. Told the Alabama delegation intended to lead a walkout that night on the final roll call, Rayburn ordered a voice vote instead, and the convention again thundered its approval. At the White House, angered by the turn events were taking, Truman spoke of Humphrey and his followers as crackpots who hoped the South would bolt. But the fact was, the convention that seemed so pathetically bogged down in its own gloom had now, suddenly, dramatically, pushed through the first unequivocal civil rights plank in the party's history. And whether Truman and his people appreciated it or not, Hubert Humphrey had done more to re-elect Truman than would anyone at the convention other than Truman himself. There were television cameras at Union Station for the president's departure that evening, and there would be more cameras at the Philadelphia station when he arrived. "No privacy, sure enough, now," he wrote, though he remained calm and composed. He had a surprise for the convention, and he knew what the effect would be. On their home screens, those still relatively few Americans who owned television sets in 1948 saw him sitting quietly at the window of his private railroad car, waiting to leave the station. The First Lady, Margaret, Charlie Ross, Clifford, Elsie, Ayers, Connolly, and Sam Rosenman were on board with him and had dinner en route, while Truman kept to himself in his room going over his notes. It was by radio, approximately halfway to Philadelphia, that he heard the Alabama delegation and part of the Mississippi delegation staged their walkout. "Hard to hear," he noted. "My daughter and my staff try to keep me from listening. Think maybe I'll be upset." "I won't be." At Philadelphia, where a fine rain was falling, he stepped from the train at 9:15, looking relaxed and spotless in a white linen suit. From the station, he was driven directly to the convention hall, now packed to capacity, the crowd noisy and full of anticipation, and, suffering intensely from the heat, suit jackets long since discarded, ties and collars undone, shirts stained dark with perspiration. The seconding speeches had begun, and as they dragged on, Truman was kept out of sight. First in McGrath's so-called office, a stifling room with no windows, then in the somewhat cooler air on an outdoor ramp near the stage entrance, overlooking an alley and the railroad tracks. He was joined by Alvin Barkley, and together they sat chatting side by side hour after hour, Truman in a straight-backed wooden chair, Barkley in a more accommodating red leather armchair that someone had borrowed from the speaker's platform. To many who had attended other national conventions over the years, this one was as bungled, as badly managed as any in memory. Newsweek called it the worst managed, most dispirited convention in American political annals. And the idea that a president of the United States had to wait his turn as Truman did under such conditions seemed the final straw. The scene would be portrayed in some accounts as one of the extreme low points of Truman's career. However, neither Truman nor Barclay saw it that way. Barclay would remember having a very agreeable visit, during which they talked about many things, politics, trivia, how to bring up daughters. To Truman, too, it was an interesting and instructive evening, as he recorded in his diary. Tom Evans, remembering the hot, horrible night, would describe Truman sitting calmly in his white suit. "And I give you my word of honor there wasn't a wrinkle in it. He was cool, collected. It didn't seem to bother him at all." To be a professional in politics required patience, often great patience, and the strength not to take things too personally. And Truman and Barclay were two veteran professional politicians. "They did what you do under such circumstances," recalled George Elsie. "They waited." Nearly 4 hours went by, as the seconding speeches were followed by the balloting for president. At 12:42, Truman was finally nominated, receiving 948 votes, while 263 votes went to Senator Richard Russell of Georgia, the last-minute candidate of the South. Then, by acclamation, Barclay was nominated for vice president. So it was nearly 2 o'clock in the morning when Truman and Barclay at last made their entrance, striding onto the platform as the band played "Hail to the Chief." Considering the time, the fatigue of the crowd, it was a scene made for failure. Any radio or television audience that Truman might have hoped for was long since asleep. To make matters a little worse, the sister of a former Pennsylvania senator suddenly released a flock of white pigeons, doves of peace, supposedly, from a floral Liberty Bell, where they had been held all night cooped up in the heat. The distraught birds careened desperately into the air every which way, smashing into the balcony, the lights, bombarding spectators, and swooping so low over the rostrum that Chairman Rayburn had to fend off several at once, to the delight of the crowd as well as Truman and Barclay, who were laughing uproariously. Years later, Truman would describe how one pigeon had actually landed on Rayburn's bald head, a claim that Rayburn, who saw nothing funny in the situation, stoutly denied, telling an interviewer, "Harry Truman's a goddamn liar. No pigeon ever lit on my head." Barclay spoke first, and briefly. Then came Truman's turn. He advanced to the microphones, his natty white suit gleaming now in the full glare of the lights. And despite the hour, the heat, the discomfort and weariness of his audience, he did what no one would have thought possible. Wasting no time with pleasantries or grand phrases, his head up as he spoke without a script, his voice strong, hands chopping the air, he brought the convention immediately to its feet, cheering. "Senator Barclay and I will win this election and make these Republicans like it. Don't you forget that." Not until this moment had anyone used the word "win" as though he meant it. The Democratic Party would win in November because the Democratic Party was the people's party. The Republicans were the party of the privileged few, as always. For the first time since 1945, he was speaking not as a leader by accident, by inheritance, but by the choice of his party. He was neither humble, nor elegant, nor lofty. The contrast with Dewey's stilted acceptance speech from the same platform could not have been greater. In manner as well as content, he was drawing the line so there could be no mistaking one candidate for the other. Mere victory was not the purpose, Dewey had proclaimed, as if he had already been elected. Our task, Dewey had said, is to fill our victory with such meaning that mankind everywhere, yearning for freedom, will take heart and move forward. Truman declared, Now it is time for us to get together and beat the common enemy. He was Cracker Barrel plain. Using words like rotten for the Republican tax bill and poppycock for the Republican platform promise to increase Social Security benefits. Life magazine called it his Lil Abner Ozark style. It was exactly in the spirit of the vehement backcountry politics he loved, and where he knew he belonged. The tradition of Andrew Jackson and William Jennings Bryan, alive and full of fight. He listed the gains for farmers, for labor, and the poor achieved under 16 years of Democratic leadership. And he tore into the Republican-dominated 80th Congress for holding up progress on housing, aid to education, medical care, and yes, civil rights. Everybody knows that I recommended to the Congress the civil rights program. I did that because I believed it to be my duty under the Constitution. Some of the members of my own party disagree with me violently on this matter, but they stand up and do it openly. People can tell where they stand. But the Republicans all profess to be for these measures, but the Congress failed to act. Indeed, he said, there was a long list of promises in the new Republican platform, things of great importance that the Republicans claimed they wanted, but that the Republicans who controlled Congress had prevented his administration from doing. It was then he unveiled his surprise, his bombshell. And speaking so rapidly, the words seemed to run together, as though all joined by hyphens. I am, therefore, calling this Congress back into session July 26th. On the 26th of July, which out in Missouri we call Turnip Day, I am going to call Congress back and ask them to pass laws to halt rising prices, to meet the housing crisis, which they are saying they are for in their platform. I shall ask them to act upon aid to education, which they say they are for, civil rights legislation, which they say they are for. The cheering and stomping in the hall was so great he had to shout to be heard. Now, my friends, if there is any reality behind the Republican platform, we ought to get some action from a short session of the 80th Congress. They can do this job in 15 days if they want to do it. They will still have time to go out and run for office. He was calling the Republicans' bluff. Let 'em make good. And the delegates were ecstatic. He had set the convention on fire, said the New York Times. He walked out there, remembered Clark Clifford, and reached down within himself, found the strength and the inspiration to make that fiery speech which was necessary to put him over. Critics on the left and the right found themselves grudgingly moved by such nerve and audacity in the face of the odds and by his effect on the crowd. They sensed, wrote Max Lerner, that this was the most militant presidential acceptance speech in either party since Bryan. They liked the fact that he came out of his corner fighting. It was a great speech for a great occasion, and as I listened, I found myself applauding. Even the New Republic bestowed the ultimate compliment. The speech was as cannily suited to the time and setting as any Franklin Roosevelt might have made. For that night at least, Harry Truman was a real leader. You can't stay cold about a man who sticks out his chin and fights, Time reported one delegate, exclaiming. Truman was likened to the brave sea captain who rallies the crew to save the sinking ship. In fact, he was exactly like the Missouri artillery captain in the Vosges Mountains in 1918, who, when his battery panicked under enemy attack, stood by his guns and, with a fierce harangue, got his men back in order again. The Republicans charged him with crude politics. The call for a special session of Congress was the act of a desperate man, the last hysterical gasp from an expiring administration. Of course, it was politics, wrote Jonathan Daniels, and effective politics, tough and native. What it did, above all, as Truman intended, was to put the focus on Congress, and thus on the split between those Republicans who, like Dewey and Earl Warren, favored much that had been set in motion since the 1930s by the New Deal, and those Republicans who remained obstructionists. It made the 80th Congress the issue, put the Republicans on the defense, and left Dewey with the dubious choice of either standing up for the 80th Congress, and thereby assume a share of responsibility for its failings, or remain aloof, which would seem less than courageous for a standard-bearer. As a political strategist, Truman had been devilishly astute, Speaker of the House Joe Martin later conceded. No president had called an emergency session of Congress in an election year since 1856. On the 25th of July, went an old Missouri saying, sow your turnips wet or dry. The Congress that met on the 26th, the 25th was a Sunday, would be known as the Turnip Congress. Arrived in Washington at the White House at 5:30 a.m., my usual time getting up, Truman jotted on his calendar for July 15th, after the return from Philadelphia. But go to bed at 6 and listen to the news. Sleep until 9:15, order breakfast, and go to the office at 10. I called a special session of the Congress. My, how the opposition screams. I'm going to attempt to make them meet their platform promises before the election. That is, according to the kept press and the opposition leadership, cheap politics. I wonder what expensive politics will be like. In a red brick auditorium in Birmingham, Alabama, 2 days later, a hurriedly assembled conference of states' rights Democrats, Dixiecrats as they now called themselves, waved Confederate flags and cheered Alabama's former governor, Frank M. Dixon, as he denounced Truman's civil rights program as an effort to reduce us to the status of a mongrel inferior race, then unanimously chose Governor Strom Thurmond of South Carolina to be their candidate for president, and for vice president, Governor Fielding L. Wright of Mississippi. The Dixiecrat platform called for the segregation of the races and the racial integrity of each race. Their hope was to deny both Truman and Dewey a majority and thus throw the election into the House of Representatives. Asked why he was breaking with the Democratic Party now, when Roosevelt had made similar promises as Truman on civil rights, Strom Thurmond responded, "But Truman really means it." On July 27th, once again at the Philadelphia Convention Hall, Henry Wallace's Progressive Citizens of America, with more than 3,000 delegates, far more than at either the Republican or Democratic conventions, rallied to acclaim Wallace, their candidate for the presidency, and Senator Glenn H. Taylor, the singing cowboy of Idaho, as their improbable choice for a running mate. Taylor, a Democrat, had campaigned for the Senate in 1944, singing, "Oh, give me a home by the Capitol Dome." Black delegates were present in impressive numbers. Nearly a third of the delegates were women. Youth predominated. The average progressive on hand in Philadelphia was described as 20 years younger and 30 pounds lighter than his or her Democratic or Republican counterpart. Comparably little alcohol was consumed, and there were no smoke-filled rooms this time. But there was also a noticeable absence of political experience on hand, and though neither Wallace nor Taylor, nor any but a small minority of delegates were communists, the conspicuous presence of such celebrated pro-communists as Paul Robeson and New York Congressman Vito Marcantonio, plus the obvious dominating presence of communists throughout the whole new helter-skelter progressive organization, was to many observers and much of the country deeply disturbing. As he had from the start of his crusade, Wallace refused to repudiate his communist support. He would not repudiate any support that came to him, he said, on the basis of interest in peace. Senator Taylor stressed the distinction between pink communists and red communists, telling reporters that the pink variety wished to change the American system through evolution rather than revolution, and that they would support the progressive cause. In contrast, the red variety would be backing Dewey on the theory that revolution would inevitably follow another Hoover-style administration. The progressive platform that emerged from the convention was virtually no different from the Communist Party platform in its denunciation of the Marshall Plan, the Truman Doctrine, the New Draft Law, and called for the destruction of American nuclear weapons, which were still the only nuclear weapons known to exist. When a Vermont farmer named James Hayford introduced an amendment saying it was not the Progressive Party's intention to endorse the foreign policy of any other country, the idea was denounced as the reflection of pressure from outside and voted down, which Wallace knew to be a mistake but did nothing to stop. Wallace delivered his acceptance speech at Philadelphia's Scheib Park before an exuberant crowd of more than 30,000 people who had paid for their seats, a progressive innovation to meet expenses. He blamed American policy for most of the world's troubles and tensions, never once criticizing the Soviet Union. Concerning Berlin, he said, there was nothing to lose by giving it up in the search for peace. "We stand against the kings of privilege who own the old parties, who attempt to control our thoughts and dominate the life of man everywhere in the world." Section 4. In the stifling, relentless heat of summer in Washington, the Turnip Congress got reluctantly underway. Tension over Berlin increased almost by the hour, and to Truman's extreme annoyance, James Forrestal launched a campaign behind closed doors to turn custody of the atomic bomb over to the military chiefs. From testimony being given before the House Un-American Activities Committee by a woman named Elizabeth Bentley and a Time magazine editor named Whitaker Chambers, both former communists, it also appeared a major spy scandal was unfolding. Visitors to the president's office found him looking tired and preoccupied. Bess and Margaret having made their annual summer departure for Missouri, he was feeling particularly alone again. "It is hot and humid and lonely," he wrote the night after putting them on the train. "Why in hell does anybody want to be a head of state? Damned if I know." He had had no change of heart about Berlin. American forces would remain. That was his decision, he said again, meeting with Marshall and Forrestal on July 19th, and he would stand by it until all diplomatic means had been tried to reach some kind of accommodation to avoid war. "We'll stay in Berlin come what may. I don't pass the buck, nor do I alibi out of any decision I make," he noted privately. He was convinced, as was Marshall, that the future of Western Europe was at stake in Berlin, not to say the well-being of the 2.5 million people in the city's allied sectors. Stalin was obviously determined to force the Allies out of Berlin. "If we wish to remain there, we would have to make a show of strength," Truman later wrote. But there was always the risk that Russian reaction might lead to war. We had to face the possibility that Russia might deliberately choose to make Berlin the pretext for war. The Allies had all of 6,500 troops in Berlin, 3,000 American, 2,000 British, 1,500 French, while the Russians had 18,000, backed by an estimated 300,000 in the east zone of Germany. With the airlift now in its fourth week, heavily laden American and British transports were roaring into Berlin hundreds of times a day and in all weather. They came in low, one after another, lumbering just over the tops of the ruined buildings as crowds gathered in clusters to watch. German children with toy planes played airlift in the rubble as the real drama went on overhead. It had been General Clay's initial estimate that possibly 700 tons of food could be delivered to the beleaguered city by air in what would be a very big operation. Already, some days, the tonnage was twice that. And now, too, almost unimaginably, coal was arriving out of the sky by the plane load. Pilots and crew were making heroic efforts. At times, planes were landing as often as every 4 minutes. British, Yorks, and Dakotas, American C-47s, and the newer, much larger four-engine C-54s, which had been dispatched to Germany from Panama, Hawaii, and Alaska. Most planes averaged 3 flights a day from Frankfurt to Berlin's Gatow or Tempelhof fields, a distance of 275 miles. Ground crews worked round the clock. "We were proud of our Air Force during the war. We're prouder of it today," said the New York Times. Already, 3 American crewmen had been killed when their C-47 crashed. Still, the effort was not enough. On July 15th, a record day, 1,450 tons were flown into Berlin. Yet to sustain the city, 2,000 tons of food alone were needed every day, plus 12,000 tons of fuel and supplies. In winter, the demands for fuel would be far greater. The mayor of Berlin had said it would be impossible to provide the necessary food and coal supplies by air. "But every expert knows," reported a London paper, "that aircraft, despite their immense psychological effect, cannot be relied upon to provision Berlin in the winter months." Allied officials in Berlin worried about the increased activity of Russian Yak fighter planes in the air corridors. Secretary of the Army Royal ordered General Clay to fly home to Washington to report to the president, which Truman thought a mistake. "My mutton-headed Secretary of the Army ordered Clay home from Germany and stirred up a terrific howdy-do for no good reason," he wrote Bess. At a National Security Council meeting on July 22nd, Clay said the people of Berlin would stand firm even if it meant further hardships. Probably the Russians would try to stop any attempt by an armed convoy to break through at this stage, but they were not likely to interfere with air traffic, unless, of course, they were determined to provoke a war. Did the Russians want war? Truman asked. Clay did not think so. No one could be sure. Truman rejected the convoy idea. When Truman inquired what problems might result from increasing the airlift, General Hoyt Vandenberg, Air Force Chief of Staff, voiced concern that American air strength elsewhere in the world would dangerously be reduced. But that was a risk Truman would take. The airlift would be vastly increased, he decided, expressing again his absolute determination to stay in Berlin. More of the big C-54 transports would be sent. Clay ordered another Berlin airfield built, and in response to his call, 30,000 Berliners went to work to clear the rubble and grade the runways. There is considerable political advantage to the administration in its battle with the Kremlin, James Rao had written in his effort to outline a political strategy for 1948. In time of crisis, the American citizen tends to back up his president. So, by such reasoning, the Berlin crisis, if kept in bounds, was made to order for Truman. Yet in nothing he said or wrote is there a sign of his playing the situation for political advantage. Rather, the grave responsibilities he bore as president at this juncture seemed to have weighed more heavily on him than at any time since assuming office. He felt the campaign and its distractions, the drain it put on his time and strength, could not be coming at a worse time, as he told Churchill in a letter on July 10th. "I am going through a terrible political trial by fire. Too bad it must happen at this time. Your country and mine are founded on the fact that the people have the right to express themselves on their leaders no matter what the crisis. We are in the midst of grave and trying times. You can look with satisfaction upon your great contribution to the overthrow of Nazism and fascism in the world. Communism, so-called, is our next great problem. I hope we can solve it without the blood and tears the other two cost." Only the day before the National Security Council meeting about Berlin, on July 21st, at the meeting arranged by Forrestal to discuss the custody of the atomic bomb, Truman had looked dreadful, and in a moment of annoyance revealed as vividly as he ever would how much more he dwelt on the horror of the atomic bomb than most people, even those close to him, imagined, or than he wished anyone to know. "The president greeted us rather solemnly. He looked worn and grim, none of the joviality that he sometimes exhibits, and we got right down to business," wrote David Lilienthal in his diary that night, when the whole scene and everything said were still fresh in his mind. "It was an important session, and a kind of seriousness hung over it that wasn't relieved a bit, needless to say, by the nature of the subject, and the fact that even at that moment some terrible thing might happen in Berlin. I rather think it was one of the most important meetings I have ever attended." Present, besides Truman, Forrestal, and Lilienthal, were the four other members of the Atomic Energy Commission, plus Secretary of the Army Royal, Secretary of the Air Force Stuart Symington, and Donald F. Carpenter, an executive of the Remington Arms Company, who was chairman of the Military Liaison Committee of the National Military Establishment. It was Carpenter who opened the discussion by reading aloud a formal letter requesting an order from the president that would turn custody of the atomic bomb over to the Joint Chiefs, on the grounds that those who would be ultimately responsible for use of the weapon should have it in their possession, to increase familiarity with it and to unify command. Truman, who did not appreciate being read to in such fashion, cut him off, saying curtly, "I can read." He turned to Lilienthal, who said the real issue was one of broad policy, and that the bomb must not be the responsibility of anyone other than the president, because of his constitutional roles as both commander-in-chief and chief magistrate. Civilian control was essential, Lilienthal said. But then Symington spoke, delivering an incongruously light-hearted account of a visit to Los Alamos where our fellas told him they should have the bomb just to be sure it worked, though one scientist had said he did not think it should ever be used. "I don't either," Truman interjected, his face expressionless. He went on, "I don't think we ought to use this thing unless we absolutely have to. It is a terrible thing to order the use of something that..." And here, as Lilienthal recorded, Truman paused and looked down at his desk rather reflectively. "That is so terribly destructive. Destructive beyond anything we have ever had. You have got to understand that this isn't a military weapon." "I shall never forget this particular expression," wrote Lilienthal. "It is used to wipe out women and children and unarmed people, and not for military uses. So we have got to treat this differently from rifles and cannon and ordinary things like that." In times past, Truman had spoken of the bomb as a military weapon like any other. In times past, he had spoken of Hiroshima and Nagasaki as military targets. Not anymore. It was an extraordinary declaration, refuting absolutely, as Lilienthal understood, any thought that Truman was insensitive to the horror of the bomb or took lightly his responsibilities as commander-in-chief. Yet Symington seemed not to understand Truman's point or the mood of the moment. "Our fellows need to get used to handling it," Symington repeated, referring now to the military. They had to understand, Truman said sternly and solemnly, that he had other considerations to weigh. "This is no time to be juggling an atom bomb around." He rose from his desk. He had had more than enough. The discussion was ended. The others stood and departed. If what worried the president in part was whether he could trust these terrible forces in the hands of the military establishment, wrote Lilienthal that night, the performance these men gave certainly could not have been reassuring. 2 days later, at the close of a cabinet meeting dealing with domestic issues, Truman held Forrestal a moment longer than the others to tell him the bomb would continue in civilian custody. Privately, Truman had been expressing concern about Forrestal, who, as Truman said, seemed lately unable to take hold. "I went down the river on the yacht Friday at noon and slept around the clock," Truman wrote to Mary Jane first thing Monday morning, July 26th. "I sure enough needed it, and I'll need some more before November. It's all so futile. Dewey, Wallace, the cockeyed Southerners, and then, if I win, which I'm afraid I will, I'll probably have a Russian war on my hands. Two wars are enough for anybody, and I've had two. I go to Congress tomorrow and read them a message requesting price control, housing, and a lot of other necessary things. And I'll in all probability get nothing. But I've got to try." On Capitol Hill, the special session of Congress opened, and later that same day, Truman sprung another surprise. Without warning, he announced executive orders to end discrimination in the armed forces and to guarantee fair employment in the civil service. His reception when he appeared before Congress the next day was noticeably cool. As a show of their resentment, some members did not even rise from their seats as he entered. He called for action on an 8-point program, including civil rights, controls on consumer credit, an excess profits tax, strengthened rent control, price controls, action on housing, farm support, aid to education, an increased minimum wage, and change in the Displaced Persons Act that discriminated against Catholics and Jews. All that he had asked for before and had been denied. From his office in Albany, Governor Dewey said nothing one way or the other, but through his campaign manager, Herbert Brownell, encouraged Republican leaders in Congress to give careful consideration to the president's program. Taft absolutely refused, saying, "No, we're not going to give that fellow anything." To Taft, as to most Republicans and much of the public, the whole affair was a cheap political ploy. The two-week session accomplished little, as Truman had anticipated, except to make his point that a Republican Congress was the great roadblock to social progress for the country, and to show the gulf between Republican promises and Republican performance. "They sure are in a stew and mad as wet hens," he told Bess. "If I can make them madder, maybe they'll do the job the old gods used to put on the Greeks and Romans." On August 4th on Capitol Hill, testifying before the House Un-American Activities Committee, the Time editor Whitaker Chambers charged that Alger Hiss, president of the Carnegie Foundation, and once one of the bright young men of the New Deal, a former official in both the Roosevelt and Truman administrations, serving 14 years in the State Department, had been his accomplice in a communist network. "For a number of years, I myself served in the underground in Washington, D.C., said Chambers. "I knew it at its top level. A member of this group was Alger Hiss." The news rocked the city. Official Washington was described as stunned with anger and disbelief. Speaking off the record, Sam Rayburn told a reporter, "There is political dynamite in this communist investigation. Don't doubt that." But when, at his press conference the following day, Truman was asked whether he thought the spy scare on Capitol Hill was only a red herring to divert public attention from inflation, he said he agreed. The hearings were a red herring to keep from doing what they ought to do. They are slandering a lot of people that don't deserve it. Could they quote him? Reporters asked. Yes, Truman replied, adding further to his troubles. A week later, with the special session of Congress ended, he was fed another line by another reporter, but this time to his benefit. Did he think it had been a do-nothing Congress? Entirely, Truman said. He thought that was quite a good name for the 80th Congress. Upstairs at the White House, the decline and fall of the old building was no longer theoretical. The floor of Margaret's sitting room, across the hall from his study, had caved in beneath her piano. His own bathroom, the president was informed, was about to collapse. None of this was disclosed, however, nor would it be until after the elections. "Can you imagine what the press would have done with this story?" Margaret would recall. "The whole mess would have been blamed on Harry Truman." Margaret's sitting room floor broke in two, but didn't fall through the family dining room ceiling, he reported to his sister on August 10th. "They propped it up and fixed it. Now my bathroom is about to fall into the red parlor. They won't let me sleep in my bedroom or use the bath." He was sleeping in the Lincoln bedroom, in Old Abe's bed, he added, and finding it quite comfortable. Chapter 14. Fighting Chance. Truman to his sister, in the autumn of 1948. "It will be the greatest campaign any president ever made. Win, lose, or draw, people will know where I stand." Section 1. The Ferdinand Magellan was the only private railroad car ever fitted out for the exclusive use of the President of the United States. 83 feet in length and painted the standard dark green of the Pullman Company, it had been built originally in 1928 as one of several luxury cars named for famous explorers, Marco Polo, David Livingston, Robert Peary, then taken over by the government for Franklin Roosevelt's use during wartime in 1942, when it was completely overhauled to become a rolling fortress. The windows were 3-inch bulletproof glass, the entire car sheathed in armor plate, sides, top, bottom, ends, and doors, with the result that it weighed a colossal 142.5 tons, or as much as a locomotive. Special trucks and wheels had to be built to carry the weight. For security reasons during the war, only the word Pullman appeared on the outside. And still, in 1948, the only distinguishing exterior features were the presidential seal fixed to the rear platform and 3 loudspeakers mounted on top of the platform roof. Inside, everything was designed for comfort. At the forward end were galley, pantry, servants' quarters, and an oak-paneled dining room, which doubled as a conference room for the president, this furnished with china cabinets, a mahogany dining table, and 6 matching chairs upholstered in gold and green-striped damask. Beyond, down a side aisle, were 4 staterooms, marked A, B, C, and D. The 2 middle rooms, B and C, forming the presidential suite with joining bath and shower. Stateroom B, for the First Lady, was a pale peach color. Stateroom C, the President's room, had blue-green walls and carpet and satin chrome fixtures. Past the staterooms at the rear was the observation lounge with blue and brown chairs and a blue sofa, walls covered with an attractive light brown tufted material resembling leather, blue velvet curtains at the windows, and at the door opening on to the rear platform. The carpeting was dark green. The whole car was air-conditioned. To its immense weight underway were added some 6,000 pounds of ice for the cooling system, and each room had a telephone that could be hooked up to a trackside outlet whenever the train was standing at a station. To Truman, who loved trains and loved seeing the country, it was the perfect way to travel, and one he had enjoyed frequently since becoming president. There had been the memorable night of poker with Churchill on the way to Missouri for the Iron Curtain speech, the long, non-political swing west in June. More recently, he had made a quick one-day tour of Michigan for a Labor Day speech at Detroit's Cadillac Square to open his campaign for re-election. Yet, for all the miles covered, the days and nights spent on board the Magellan, these prior expeditions had been only prologue to the odyssey that began the morning of Friday, September 17, 1948, when the Magellan, at the end of a 17-car special train, stood waiting on Track 15 beneath the cavernous shed of Washington's Union Station. In June, he had gone 9,000 miles. Now, on what was to become famous as the Whistle Stop Campaign, he would travel, all told, 21,928 miles, as far nearly as around the world, as far nearly as the Voyage of Magellan. The idea was his own. "I want to see the people," he had said. There would be 3 major tours. First, cross-country to California again for 15 days, then a 6-day tour of the Middle West, followed by a final hard-hitting 10 days in the big population centers of the Northeast and a return trip home to Missouri. "There were no deep-hid schemes, no devious plans," remembered Charlie Ross, "nothing that could be called in the language of political analysts high strategy." the president would simply take his case to the country in a grueling, no-quarter contest. Mileage meant crowds. According to Ross, it had been Truman's original intention to go into all 48 states, including those of the Deep South. He rather relished the prospect of facing up to the Dixiecrats on their home grounds. How did he expect to be received in the South? Truman was asked. Why, with courtesy, of course, he replied. The idea of a Southern trip held appeal, wrote Ross, because it would show that the boss had courage. But the plan was ultimately ruled out on the ground that every ounce of energy should be used in places where material political gain might be expected. The political courage of the president had already been amply demonstrated. So, for a total of 33 days, more than a month, the Magellan was to be center stage for a fast-rolling political roadshow, which, as was said, had but one act, and that one act built around just one performer. We play more towns than the world of Mirth or Bronx comedians, and we work longer hours, an accompanying reporter would write. For Truman, away from the White House, the big private car would be home, office, presidential command center, campaign headquarters, and the place where day after day he would somehow, bravely, almost inconceivably keep hope alive. No president in history had ever gone so far in quest of support from the people, or with less cause for the effort, to judge by informed opinion. Nor would any presidential candidate ever again attempt such a campaign by railroad. As a test of his skills and judgment as a professional politician, not to say his stamina and disposition at age 64, it would be like no other experience in his long, often difficult career, as he himself understood perfectly. More than any other event in his public life or in his presidency thus far, it would reveal the kind of man he was. "It's going to be tough on everybody," he told the staff, "but that's the way it's got to be. I know I can take it. I'm only afraid that I'll kill some of my staff. And I like you all very much, and I don't want to do that." The rest of the train was made up of diners, lounges, sleepers, a press car, a dynamo car for power, and a communications car, a converted baggage car operated by the Signal Corps, where radio teletype would provide continuous contact with Washington and thus the rest of the world, a point of crucial importance to Truman, who had become more and more uneasy over the situation in Berlin. "I have a terrible feeling that we are very close to war," he had written privately the night of September 13th. Security would be a major undertaking. Every grade crossing would have to be checked in advance by the Secret Service. A pilot train, a single locomotive and one car, would run 5 miles ahead of the president's train to absorb any possible trouble. The railroad official in charge, who had been handling presidential trips since the time of Warren G. Harding, admitted he was a nervous wreck. "Every grade crossing has to be manned when the train passes, and I just can't tell you how many switches have to be spiked until we've moved on," he told a reporter. Once rolling, the train would travel under the code name POTUS for President of the United States, which gave it the right of way everywhere in the country. Truman liked to move fast. Roosevelt, because of his infirmities, had preferred a smooth, easy pace of no more than 35 miles an hour when traveling in the Magellan. Truman liked to go about 80. A cheer went up from the moderate-sized crowd gathered at the Union Station platform, the sound echoing under the vaulted roof as his limousine, easing through a break in the crowd, pulled right to the gate. Truman stepped out looking positively buoyant, Margaret close behind. Marshall and Barclay had come to see him off. The First Lady would catch up with the caravan at Des Moines. Charlie Ross, Clark Clifford, Matt Connolly, George Elsie, Charlie Murphy, White House physician Wallace Graham, and Rose Conway, the president's secretary, were all present and waiting to go on board, in addition to several White House stenographers, Jonathan Daniels, who would help with speeches, and three new speechwriters, David M. Noyes, Albert Z. Carr, and John Franklin Carter, Bill Boyle of Kansas City, an old Truman friend and aide who had served on the Truman Committee, would, like Matt Connolly, be handling political chores. Counting the whole staff, the Secret Service detail, 44 reporters and 5 photographers, the complete entourage numbered some 70 people. The one notable absentee was Harry Vaughan, who would remain out of sight and out of contact with the press for the duration of the campaign at Truman's request. With everything ready, Truman and Barclay posed together on the rear platform for a few last pictures. "Mow 'em down, Harry," Barclay exhorted. "I'm going to fight hard. I'm going to give 'em hell," said Truman, setting the theme at the start. The odds against him looked insurmountable. The handicaps of the Truman campaign, wrote columnist Marquis Childs, one of the writers on board, loomed large as the Rocky Mountains. Henry Wallace and the Dixiecrats had split the Democratic Party 3 ways. Conceivably, New York and the South were already lost to Truman. The victory of the Republicans in the elections of 1946 had been resounding. And ever since the Civil War, the party winning the off-year election had always gone on to win the presidency in the next election. At Washington dinner parties, as Bess Truman had heard, the talk was of who would be in the Dewey cabinet. Some prominent Democrats in Washington were already offering their homes for sale. Even the president's mother-in-law thought Dewey would win. In the West, where Truman had made an all-out effort in June, predictions were that at best he might win 19 of the 71 electoral votes at stake. Only Arizona, with 4 votes, looked safe for Truman. And the West was essential. A Gallup poll of farm voters gave Dewey 48%, Truman 38%. And the farm vote, too, was essential. On September 9th, a full week before Truman's train departed Washington, Elmo Roper, a widely respected sampler of public opinion, had announced his organization would discontinue polling, since the outcome was already so obvious. "My whole inclination," Roper said, "is to predict the election of Thomas E. Dewey by a heavy margin and devote my time and effort to other things." The latest Roper poll showed Dewey leading by an unbeatable 44-31%. More important, said Roper, such elections were decided early. "Political campaigns are largely ritualistic. All the evidence we have accumulated since 1936 tends to indicate that the man in the lead at the beginning of the campaign is the man who is the winner at the end of it. The winner, it appears, clinches his victory early in the race and before he has uttered a word of campaign oratory." The idea that the campaign was largely ritualistic, a formality only, became commonplace. Life, in its latest issue, carried a picture of Governor Dewey and his staff under the headline, "Albany Provides Preview of Dewey Administration." Yet, inexplicably, Truman had drawn tremendous crowds in Michigan on Labor Day. 100,000 people had filled Cadillac Square. By train and motorcade, he rolled through Grand Rapids, Lansing, Hamtramck, Pontiac, and Flint, where, to Truman and his staff, the crowds were even more impressive. "Cadillac Square, that was organized," remembered Matt Connolly. "But we rode from there up to Pontiac, and from Detroit to Pontiac I'd see people along the highway. This was not organized, and there were a lot of them out there." According to police estimates, the turnout at Truman's six stops in Michigan totaled more than 500,000 people. Often in later years, the big Truman crowds would be remembered as a phenomenon of the final weeks of the campaign. But this was a misconception. They were there from the start, in Michigan and in traditionally Republican Iowa, in Davenport, Iowa City, Grinnell, Des Moines, beginning September 18th, his first full day heading west. "Newsmen were nonplussed," reported Time. "All across Republican Iowa, large crowds turned out. A good deal of the cheering was enthusiastic." The main event of the day was the National Plowing Contest at Dexter, 40 miles west of Des Moines, where Truman spoke at noon in blazing sunshine, standing front and center on a high, broad platform, a sea of faces before him, a giant plowing scoreboard behind. The crowd numbered 90,000. The long horizons were rimmed with ripening corn. The atmosphere was of a vast county fair in good times, with throngs of healthy, well-fed, sun-baked, and obviously prospering people enjoying the day, as dust swirled in a steady wind and more families arrived in new trucks and automobiles. Lined up in an adjoining field, their bright colors gleaming in the sun, were perhaps 50 private airplanes. It was a Republican crowd. Iowa had a Republican governor. All 8 Iowa representatives in Congress and both senators were Republicans. In the last presidential election, Iowa's 10 electoral votes had gone to Dewey. But more important to Truman, nearly all his audience were farmers. And in the Depression, he knew, Iowa farmers had voted for Roosevelt. Years before, in 1934, when he had been running for the Senate the first time, a St. Louis reporter had written, "In a fight, this quiet man can and does hurl devastating fire." Now, at Dexter, he ripped into the Republican, "gluttons of privilege, cold men, cunning men," in a way no one had heard a presidential candidate speak since the days of William Jennings Bryan. The difference between Republicans and Democrats was a difference in attitude. "You remember the big boom and the great crash of 1929? You remember that in 1932 the position of the farmer had become so desperate that there was actual violence in many farming communities? You remember that insurance companies and banks took over much of the land of small independent farmers. 223,000 farmers lost their farms. I wonder how many times you have to be hit on the head before you find out who's hitting you. The Democratic Party represents the people. It is pledged to work for agriculture. The Democratic Party puts human rights and human welfare first. These Republican gluttons of privilege are cold men. They are cunning men. They want a return of the Wall Street economic dictatorship." It was language that, to many, seemed oddly archaic and out of place in the midst of such obvious prosperity. The Des Moines Register would point to the incongruity of being a prophet of doom to an audience in time of harvest of bumper crops. Truman, it was said, was sadly miscast as the new Bryan, his speech harsh and demagogic. But he was leading to something quite specific. In June, when rewriting the charter for the Commodity Credit Corporation, CCC, the Agency for Federal Farm Loans, Congress had included an obscure provision prohibiting the CCC from acquiring additional grain storage bins. It was meant as an economy measure. But since farmers were required to use storage facilities approved or maintained by the CCC in order to qualify for price supports, they stood to lose heavily in the event of wheat and corn crops too large for the existing facilities to handle. If there were no approved bins to store the surplus of a bumper yield, then for the farmers, a bumper yield could mean not prosperity but heavy losses. The bill had gone through unopposed by the Democrats, and Truman had signed it. But that was in June, when no one was paying it much attention. Now the prospect of a bumper year was no longer hypothetical. The corn harvest would not begin until October, but all that day crossing Iowa since early morning, those on board the train had seen little else but corn in abundance. The talk in Iowa was of yields of 135 bushels to the acre. It was the Republican Congress that rewrote the charter for the Commodity Credit Corporation, Truman now charged at Dexter. The Republican Congress, said Truman, had stuck a pitchfork in the farmer's back. Nor would the Republicans stop with limits on grain storage. The whole structure of price supports was in jeopardy. "I'm not asking you to vote for me. Vote for yourselves," he said, a theme he would strike over and over. To reporters covering the event, the huge crowd seemed friendly, yet unmoved. But then, who was to say? Afterward, in a tent behind the platform, a perspiring president in his shirt sleeves pulled up a wooden folding chair to a long table with a red check cloth and ate country-fried chicken and prize-winning cake and pie with 30 farmers and their wives. Asked if he would please speak again, only on a more personal level this time, Truman agreed and returned to the platform. Was it true he had once been able to plow the straightest furrows in his part of Missouri, he was asked. "Yes," said Truman, "but only according to an exceedingly partial witness, his mother. But he did have a reputation, he said, for never leaving a skip place when he sowed wheat. My father always used to raise so much fuss about a skip place." He talked of the 12-inch horse-drawn gang plow he rode at Grandview, and how it had taken him sometimes 4 days to plow a field. He didn't want to go back to those days. "I don't want to turn back the clock. I don't want to go back to the horse and buggy age, although some of our Republican friends do," he said, and this brought a warm cheer. "He was delightful, and the people were delighted," wrote Richard Revere of The New Yorker, who had thought the earlier speech deplorable. Truman had begun the day at 5:45. There had been 6 stops and 6 speeches before Dexter. After Dexter, he spoke at Des Moines, Melcher, and Chariton, Iowa. At each stop, reported the Des Moines Register, the listeners massed for his rear platform talk were larger than the town's population. "You stayed at home in 1946, and you got the 80th Congress, and you got just exactly what you deserved," he said at Chariton. "You didn't exercise your God-given right to control this country. Now you're going to have another chance." He was on a crusade for the welfare of the everyday man, he said next, across the state line at Trenton, Missouri. At Polo, Missouri, just after 8 p.m., he told the delighted crowd he had not been sure whether he would be able to stop there, but that the railroad had finally consented. It was his 13th speech of the day, and he was sounding a little hoarse. After a brief visit home in Independence the next day, Sunday, September 19th, he was on his way again. Crossing Kansas that night, the engineer had the train up to 105 miles per hour, which Truman, from his chair in the lounge, decided was too fast, considering the weight of the Magellan and what might happen to the forward cars should the engineer suddenly have to stop. Calmly, quietly, he asked Charlie Ross to send word to the engineer that there was no great hurry. 80 miles an hour would do. Understand me when I speak of what the Republicans have been doing. I'm not talking about the average Republican voter, Truman told the 25,000 people spread across the lawn of the state capitol at Denver. Nobody knows better than I that man for man, individually, most Republicans are fine people. But there's a big distinction between the individual Republican voter and the policies of the Republican Party. Something happens to Republican leaders when they get control of the government. Republicans in Washington have a habit of becoming curiously deaf to the voice of the people. They have a hard time hearing what the ordinary people of the country are saying. But they have no trouble at all hearing what Wall Street is saying. They are able to catch the slightest whisper from big business and the special interests. He had just one strategy. Attack, attack, attack. Carry the fight to the enemy's camp. He hammered the Republicans relentlessly in speeches at Grand Junction, Colorado, Helper, Springville, and Provo, Utah. Selfish men have always tried to skim the cream from our natural resources to satisfy their own greed. And their instrument in this effort has always been the Republican Party, he charged at Salt Lake City to a standing-room-only crowd in the cavernous Mormon tabernacle. At Ogden, he warned of bloodsuckers who have offices in Wall Street. The 80th Congress, he said at Reno, Nevada, was run by a bunch of old mossbacks still living back in 1890. The country must not go backward, he would keep saying over and over, because he felt with all his heart that Americans were a forward-looking people, and that his own program, as he had told Clark Clifford earlier, was a forward-looking program. If the old guard Republicans were to get control under a Republican administration, they would dismantle the progress made by the New Deal and in foreign affairs, retreat back into isolationism, which would be disastrous for the country and the world. He was certain of this and determined to keep it from happening. To the crowd beside the Southern Pacific tracks at Roseville, California, he declared the Republican do-nothing Congress tried to choke you to death in this valley by cutting off appropriations for publicly owned electric power lines. You have got a terrible congressman here in this district. He is one of the worst, he told the citizens of Fresno, referring to Republican Bertrand W. Gearhart, who had once denounced George Marshall on the floor of the House. One correspondent, Robert Donovan of the New York Herald Tribune, would later characterize the Truman campaign as sharp speeches fairly criticizing Republican policy and defending New Deal liberalism mixed with sophistry, bunkum piled higher than haystacks, and demagoguery tooting merrily down the track. Truman was at his best speaking to small crowds and without notes, and often when the subject was himself, his family, his own pioneer background and outlook on life. He was described by some of the Eastern reporters as a feed mill type of talker, and excellent indeed with a small town crowd. These little speeches, thought Charlie Ross, were more important than the major addresses. They got him close to the people. At both Grand Junction, Colorado, and the Mormon Tabernacle in Salt Lake City. He reminisced about Grandfather Solomon Young and his journeys over the plains, his friendship with Brigham Young.
"Oh, I wish my grandfather could see me now," he said spontaneously at Salt Lake, and the audience first laughed, then broke into prolonged applause. "Those pioneers had faith and they had energy," he said, seeming himself to embody an excess of both qualities. Though he refused to put on Indian war bonnets or to kiss babies, he was thankful always for the gifts ceremoniously presented at stop after stop. Hats, spurs, baskets of fruit. "I'll be eating peaches from now until I get to Washington." And nearly always he had something to say about the local scenery, local history, local achievements and interests. "They tell me," he said at Mojave, "that in 1883, that was the year before I was born, that a gentleman by the name of Webb built 10 grand big wagons here in this town, bought himself 100 head of mules, and began to haul borax out of the Mojave Desert. And that was the origin of 20 mule team borax, which we always kept in the house when I was a kid. I never thought I would be here as president at the place where it originated and talking to you people about your interests in the welfare of the country." He expressed love of home, love of the land, the virtues and old verities of small-town America, his America. "Naturally, if we don't think our hometown is the greatest in the world, we are not very loyal citizens. We all should feel that way," he told the loyal citizens of American Fork, Utah. "You don't get any double talk from me," he declared from a brightly decorated bandstand first thing in the morning sunshine at Sparks, Nevada. "I'm either for something or against it, and you know it. You know what I stand for." What he stood for, he said again and again, was a government of and for the people, not the special interests. He was friendly, cheerful, and full of fight. "You are the government," he said time after time. "Practical politics is government. Government starts from the grassroots. I think the government belongs to you and me as private citizens. I'm calling this trip a crusade. It's a crusade of the people against the special interests. And if you back me up, we're going to win." The basic issue of this campaign is as simple as can be. It's the special interests against the people. "I'm here on a serious mission, and because it is so serious, I propose to speak to you as plainly as I can. In 1946, you know, two-thirds of you stayed home and didn't vote. You wanted a change. Well, you got it. You got the change. You got just exactly what you deserved. Now use your judgment. Keep the people in control of the government. I not only want you to vote for me, but I want you to vote for yourselves. And if you vote for yourselves, you'll vote for the Democratic ticket." The crowds would be gathered at station stops, often from early morning, waiting for him to arrive. Men and boys perched on rooftops and nearby signal towers for a better view. There would be a high school band standing by, ready to play the national anthem or Hail to the Chief, or to struggle through the Missouri Waltz, a song Truman particularly disliked, but that it was his fate to hear repeated hundreds of times over. His train would ease into the station as the band blared, the crowd cheered. Then, accompanied by three or four local politicians, usually a candidate for Congress or a state party chairman who had boarded the train at a prior stop, Truman would step from behind the blue velvet curtain onto the platform, and the crowd, large or small, would cheer even more. One of the local politicians would then introduce the President of the United States, and the crowd would cheer again. At the 10-minute stops, he would speak for 5 minutes, beginning with praise for the local candidate for Congress or some issue of local interest,
then moving quickly from the general to the particular. He would lambaste the Republican Congress for the high cost of living or failing to vote the grain storage bins, for the Taft-Hartley Act or the rich man's tax bill, for slashing federal support for irrigation and hydroelectric power projects in the West. It was the Republicans in Congress who were holding back progress in the Central Valley of California. Republicans, at heart, had no real interest in the West, not in water, not in public power. The Republicans who controlled the appropriations committees in the House and Senate, those upon whom the future of federal projects in the Central Valley depended, were not Californians. They were not Westerners. They are Eastern Republicans. "Give 'em hell, Harry," someone would shout from the crowd. News accounts of his promise to Barclay to give 'em hell having swept the country by now. The cry went up at one stop after another, often more than once. "Give 'em hell, Harry," which always brought more whoops, laughter, and yells of approval, but especially when he tore into the 80th Congress. "I never gave anybody hell," he would later say. "I just told the truth, and they thought it was hell." At the close, he would ask if they would like to meet his family, and the crowd never failed in its response. The routine became standard. He would first introduce Bess, Ms. Truman, who would step out from behind the blue curtain looking pleased and motherly. He would take her hand and she would stand at his right, saying nothing. If the crowd was small and especially friendly, he would refer to her as the boss. Then proudly he would present Miss Margaret, whose appearance nearly always brought the biggest cheer of all, and to the obvious delight of her father. She would be carrying an armful of roses, a few of which she would throw to the crowd. Truman would lean over the brass rail to grasp one or two outstretched hands. Someone would signal the local band to start playing again, and with warning toots of the whistle, with reporters scrambling to get back on board, the crowd cheering and the three Trumans waving, the train would pull slowly out of the station. "No matter what the outcome of the campaign," wrote Richard Revere, "millions of Americans would remember for the rest of their lives this final tableau of the three traveling Trumans. It will be a picture to cherish, and it will stand Harry Truman in good stead for the rest of his life. Traveling with him, you get the feeling that the American people who have seen him and heard him at his best would be willing to give him just about anything he wants except the presidency." It could be said also they had seen and heard for themselves a president who was friendly and undisguised, loyal to his party, fond of his family, a man who cared about the country and about them, who believed the business of government was their business, and who didn't whine when he was in trouble, but kept bravely, doggedly plugging away, doing his best, his duty as he saw it, and who was glad to be among them. He wasn't a hero or an original thinker. His beliefs were their beliefs. Their way of talking was his way of talking. He was on their side. He was one of them. If he stumbled over a phrase or a name, he would grin and try again, and they would smile with him. There is an agreeable warm-heartedness and simplicity about Truman that is genuine, wrote Richard Strout for his column in The New Republic. A presidential train was probably the worst of all places to gauge public opinion, he added. Nevertheless, reporters keep pinching themselves at the size of the crowds and their cordial response. At Los Angeles, at Gilmore Stadium, with screen stars Lauren Bacall, Humphrey Bogart, and Ronald Reagan, all ardent liberal Democrats, seated prominently on stage beside him, Truman hit hard at Henry Wallace, warning liberal Democrats to think again if they thought a vote for the third party was a vote for peace. With communists guiding and using it, the third party did not represent American ideals. A vote for Wallace only played into the hands of the Republican forces of reaction. Now was the hour for the liberal forces of America to unite. Think again. Don't waste your vote. At San Diego, 10,000 turned out, despite threatening skies in the early hour of 9 a.m., and gave him the most enthusiastic welcome thus far. After the stop at Oceanside, California, where the train pulled within sight of the rolling surf of the Pacific, the route was east again. By then, Friday, September 24th, he had been on the road a week. And while some on board had already begun to show signs of strain, Truman, who bore much the heaviest burden, remained steady as a rock. Nor had he left the duties and concerns of the Oval Office. A White House pouch arrived daily. Papers requiring his signature. Letters to be signed. Letters to be read. Reports from department heads. Reports to Congress. Sealed manila envelopes marked confidential, as well as copies of the Kansas City Star and the Independence Examiner. A memorandum from head usher Howell Krim reported on the quantity of plaster descending in the East Room. The Berlin crisis and the risks involved in the airlift weighed heavily on Truman. Though the quantity of supplies being flown into the city had increased since August, the disturbing truth was that the airlift was supplying less than half of what Berlin needed. "We are not quite holding our own," General Clay had cabled. In another few days in Dallas, at Truman's request, General Walter Bedell Smith, the American ambassador to Moscow, would come quietly aboard the train to give his assessment to Truman of Stalin's mood and the chances of war. Staff work on board had acquired a pattern of a kind, though little about it was systematic or efficient or ever very formal. Of the major speeches, only the one at Dexter, Iowa, had been prepared well in advance. The rest, for Denver, Salt Lake City, Los Angeles, were produced underway, with the combined efforts of Ross, Clifford, Elsie, Murphy, and the new writers Noyes, Carr, and Carter. No speech was ever the work of one writer, and no speech failed to go through several drafts. Truman himself went over every line, worked painstakingly on every draft, and was the first to approve suggested deletions. "That's good," he would say. "Never use two words when one will do best." Convoluted structure and high-blown or evasive phrases greatly annoyed him. "That's not the way I would say it," he would remark as the group sat around the mahogany table in the dining room of the Magellan, working late into the night. "Let's just say what we mean." Nobody had any special pride of authorship, but we did get into heated arguments now and then, wrote Ross. The president would grin and say, "All right, you fellows fight it out and I'll decide." Ross wanted Truman to ease up on the abusive language and state his case in more dignified fashion. But Truman was determined to keep the heat on. He had also introduced a new line about the housing shortage that made the others wince. If they went to the polls and did their duty on November 2nd, Truman would tell the crowd with a smile, then he wouldn't have to go hunting around in this housing shortage. He could stay right in the White House. It was a line he liked and that he was sure the people liked. So he kept it. Background material, particularly material useful for the rear platform appearances, was provided by a research division of the Democratic National Committee. Three or four bright young men who had been holed up in a small office off DuPont Circle in Washington, and who, according to George Elsie, worked like dogs and ground out an incredible amount of material. All kinds of historical, literary, political, and economic data flowed through them,
and news clippings, photostats of useful documents, anything that would give spark and vitality and originality and vigor to President Truman's campaign effort. Elsie's task was to sort and edit it all, then keep the president supplied with pertinent items to choose from, and in proper order as they sped along. I was the whistle-stopper on the job, doing the outlines, getting the stuff together, and feeding these back to him, he remembered. I felt I got 25 years' exercise walking from my car to his car in the weeks of the campaign. Bill Boyle would be credited with planning every inch of Truman's itinerary. Constantly in touch with state party leaders, he advised Truman on which towns mattered and why. Traveling ahead of the train as advance men were Oscar Chapman, the Undersecretary of Interior, and Donald Dawson of the White House staff. They were responsible for all the details of local ceremonies, to make sure the local politicians knew where and when to come on board Truman's train, and that no such fiasco as the empty hall at Omaha in June ever happened again. Between stops, in the comparative quiet and privacy of the Magellan, the candidate himself remained even-tempered and steadfastly confident. The strain on him was unrelenting, yet he showed no signs of wear and tear or faltering expectations. He knew he was behind, and in private said so. But he was also sure he would catch up and move ahead by November, when it would count. A view shared by almost no one else on board, though few other than the press ever talked about it. Once, late in an especially long day, a noticeably weary First Lady asked Clark Clifford if he thought the president really believed he could win, and Clifford said yes. "He gives every appearance under every condition," Clifford answered. "Oh," she said, "I don't know where it comes from." Though several of his staff were gravely concerned about the split in the Democratic ranks, the campaigns underway by the Progressives and the Dixiecrats, Truman seems never to have taken the candidacies of Wallace and Thurmond as serious threats. Henry Wallace was running hard. In August, he had bravely campaigned through the South, decrying segregation and refusing to stay in hotels that enforce discrimination. In North Carolina, angry crowds pelted him with eggs and rotten tomatoes. Traveling the rest of the country mainly by plane, he would eventually roll up more mileage even than Truman. His main theme remaining constant throughout. The Progressive Party was the peace party that could end the Cold War through direct negotiations with the Soviet Union. At Los Angeles, speaking at the same stadium where Truman had, Wallace drew a larger crowd than Truman had, and it was a paying crowd. But attendance overall at Wallace rallies and speeches was falling off. The excitement of his progressive crusade plainly in decline, as he was perceived and portrayed more and more in the press as playing Moscow's game. Of the Republicans and Democrats, he said they were equally sinister in their policies, both being in the grip of Wall Street and the Pentagon. Strom Thurmond kept harping on states' rights and demanding that the evil forces in control of the Democratic Party be cast out. He called Truman's Fair Employment Practices Committee communistic. Racial integration of the armed services was un-American. The South must hold the line. "There's not enough troops in the Army to break down segregation and admit the Negro into our homes, our eating places, our swimming pools, and our theaters." He and the Dixiecrats would win 140 electoral votes in the South, Thurmond said, more than sufficient to force the election into the House. But almost no one took the claim seriously,
and Truman least of all. In his speeches, Truman never mentioned Wallace or Thurman by name. But then, never in the major addresses or in any of his largely extemporaneous remarks to small crowds in out-of-the-way places did he speak of Dewey by name. Dewey was always "my Republican opponent" or "the other fellow." He never criticized or ridiculed Dewey in a personal way. Interestingly, Dewey was never even a subject of discussion on board the Ferdinand Magellan. There was no talk of Dewey's personality or failings, no gossiping about him, or ever any consideration of attacking him on personal grounds. It would not be recalled that the president ever even mentioned Dewey. Section 2. Governor Thomas E. Dewey had gone aboard his own campaign train at Albany on Sunday, September 19th, 2 days after Truman left Washington, and Dewey, too, delivered his first major speech in Iowa, at Des Moines on Monday the 20th, 2 days after Truman spoke at the Dexter Plowing Contest. Starting later than Truman, Dewey would travel nowhere near so far, and at a much more leisurely pace. And he would deliver far fewer speeches. All this, like everything about the Dewey campaign, having been carefully thought out in advance. As the candidate and his advisers proudly informed the press, nothing was to be left to chance. Press coverage of Dewey's advance across the country was also to be far greater than that Truman received. There were 92 reporters riding the Dewey Victory Special, 98 by the time the train reached California, roughly twice the number traveling with the president. And they were catered to, their everyday needs handled with a skill and efficiency unknown on the Truman train. Copies of the candidate's speeches were nearly always available 24 hours in advance, as they seldom ever were on the Truman train. An internal public address system fed Dewey's remarks directly to the press car and dining cars, so reporters need not bother leaving their air-conditioned comforts. Coffee and sandwiches were provided to reporters at odd hours, their laundry attended to, their luggage moved from train to hotel for overnight stops. To those who had traveled with both candidates, the Truman operation, by comparison, was 40 years behind the times. "If you wanted anything laundered on the Truman train, you did it yourself in a Pullman basin," Richard Revere informed his readers in The New Yorker. "When you detrained anywhere for an overnight stay, it was every man for himself. You carried your duffel and scrambled for your food. If a man was such a slave to duty that he felt obliged to hear what the president said in his back platform addresses, he had to climb down off the train, run to the rear end, mingle with the crowd, and listen. Often this was a hazardous undertaking, for the president was given to speaking late at night to crowds precariously assembled on sections of roadbed built up 15 or 20 feet above the surrounding land. The natives knew the contours of the ground, but the reporters did not. More than one of them tumbled down a cindery embankment." A condescending tone entered into a lot of what was written about Truman and his efforts. His whole campaign, as Jonathan Daniels said, was given a sort of rube reputation by the largely Eastern press traveling with him. The Dewey campaign, by contrast, was described as slick, tidy as a pin, everything handled with junior executive briskness. The favorite drink on board the Dewey Victory Special was the martini, not bourbon as on the Truman train. The favorite game was bridge, not poker. Dewey himself was cool, careful, supremely self-confident, and from the start elevated in tone. "Tonight we enter upon a campaign to unite America," he told the crowd at Des Moines,
where reportedly he was leading Truman by a resounding 51-37%. "We propose to install in Washington," Dewey said, "an administration which has faith in the American people, a warm understanding of their needs, and the competence to meet them. We will rediscover the essential unity of our people and the spiritual strength which makes our country great. We will begin to move forward again, shoulder to shoulder." There were no harsh or divisive accusations, no pitting of farmers against Wall Street, no pitchforks in the back, or angry staccato assaults on any segment of government or society. A Republican congressman from Minnesota, August H. Anderson, had written to warn Dewey of discontent among farmers, saying, "We cannot win without the farm vote." But Dewey refrained also from any mention of farm problems. His voice was deep and resonant, as flowing as the smoothest radio preacher. Everything Truman's voice was not. Dewey was dignified. He spoke ill of no one, offended no one. He had no surprises. He took no risks. And the pattern prevailed, his text seldom more rousing than a civics primer. "Government must help industry, and industry must cooperate with government," he would say with a grand preacher-like sweep of the right arm. "America's future is still ahead of us," he also said. They were not speeches of the kind he had given in 1944, when he had hit hard and often, charging Franklin Roosevelt with failure to end the Depression, failure to build American defenses before Pearl Harbor. At one point, he had called Roosevelt truly the indispensable man, indispensable to the ill-assorted, power-hungry conglomeration of city bosses, communists, and career bureaucrats, which now compose the New Deal. But there would be no such harangue this time, because this time Dewey was not the challenger. This time, he had the election sewed up. It was an odd reversal of roles, with the incumbent president running as the challenger and his opponent performing as though he were already elected and the campaign a mere formality. Dewey had only to mark time, be careful, make no mistakes, say or do nothing silly or improper, and the presidency was his. So the speeches were kept unceasingly positive. He was for unity, for peace, for constructive change. He was not running against the New Deal. He was not even running against Harry Truman, whom he never mentioned, any more than Truman spoke of him, which was another odd turn. "Governor Dewey is deliberately avoiding any sharp controversy with the Democratic incumbent," reported the New York Times as the victory special rolled through California, passing at one point within only a few miles of the Truman train. In some ways, the two candidates were much alike. Both were efficient with their time, alert and energetic. They always looked spanking clean and pressed. Both were men of medium stature, though Truman, the one so often referred to disparagingly as the little man, was an inch taller than Dewey, who was 5'8". And unlike Truman, Dewey was extremely sensitive about his height. They were each diligent career public servants who genuinely believed that good government was possible and the best politics. They both loved music. Truman had dreamed of being a concert pianist, Dewey of being a concert singer, and still loved to sing, especially Oklahoma in the bathtub. Each was devoted to his family. Dewey's wife, Frances, a particularly photogenic woman with a somewhat shy but winsome manner, was generally seen as an asset to his political career. And they had two teenage sons, Tom Jr. and John. Like Truman, Dewey was a product of small-town middle America. He had grown up in Owosso, Michigan, where his father, the editor of the local newspaper, was vitally interested in politics, just as John Truman had been. Beyond there, however, the similarities ended. Where Truman was at heart a 19th-century man, raised, educated, formed in thought and outlook in the era before World War I, Dewey was of a different generation. Dewey had never lived with the burden of farm debt. He had never been to war. He had never been bankrupt. Born in 1902, 18 years after Truman, he was the first candidate for president born in the 20th century. His Middle American origins, moreover, were hardly apparent any longer. Educated at the University of Michigan and the Columbia Law School in New York, he had made his entire career in the East, and with his Homburg hats and cultivated voice, he had left Owosso far behind. Where Truman had been, as Nellie Nolan said, a late bloomer all along, attaining prominence only past the age of 50, Dewey had soared almost from the start, achieving national fame as the crusading district attorney of New York while still in his 30s. He was the gangbuster, a national hero. In 1938, at age 36, he had made his first run for governor of New York. Trying again in 1942, he became New York's first Republican governor in 20 years. Running for a second term in 1946, he rolled up the biggest victory in the state's history, winning by nearly 700,000 votes. As governor, he cut taxes, doubled state aid to education, raised salaries for state employees, reduced the state's overall indebtedness by over $100 million, and put through the first state law in the country prohibiting racial discrimination in employment. If elected now, he would be, at 46, the youngest president since Theodore Roosevelt. Given his youth, ambition, his proven ability, it was not inconceivable that Thomas E. Dewey could serve as long as or longer than Franklin Roosevelt. If he were to have 4 full terms, he would be in the White House until 1965. And even then, he would still be younger than was Truman in 1948. But as often noted, Dewey was also extremely cautious and cold in manner, at least in public, which for a politician was what mattered. On the campaign trail, he seemed not to care for the gifts he was offered or to mix with the crowd. He was incapable of unbending. Where Truman, at the end of a platform talk, would ask, "Would you like to meet my family?" Dewey would say stiffly, "I'm pleased to present Mrs. Dewey." "Smile, Governor," a photographer had called at a campaign stop in 1944. "I thought I was," said Dewey. A remark attributed to the wife of a New York Republican politician would be widely repeated. "You have to know Mr. Dewey well," she said, "in order to dislike him." He was so self-controlled as to seem mechanical. "Dewey came on stage," wrote Richard Revere, "like a man who has been mounted on casters and given a tremendous shove from behind." And there was a hard look in the dark eyes, a look that had served him well as a prosecutor. "Those eyes tell you this guy doesn't crap around," a staff man once said. It was Dewey's small, dark, bottle-brush mustache that the public knew him best for and that many people disliked, or wished he would get rid of, mustaches having been long out of fashion among public men. He had grown it on a bicycle tour of France years earlier, and kept it because his wife approved. To the actress Ethel Barrymore, the mustache and Dewey's diminutive size made him look like the bridegroom on the wedding cake, a remark greatly amplified by the acerbic, much-quoted daughter of Theodore Roosevelt, Alice Roosevelt Longworth, and that may have done Dewey real harm in the campaign. To the reporters on board his train, he seemed aloof, even haughty. They were kept at a distance, and though they were certain he would win, and most believed he would make an efficient chief executive, almost none of them liked him, which was quite the reverse of how they felt about Truman. Dewey's mechanical smile and his bland refusal to deal with issues have got under everybody's skin, wrote Richard Strout of The Mood in the press car. Dewey, it was cracked, was the only man who could strut sitting down. In sharp contrast to Truman, who had never wanted to be president, Dewey had started running for the job as early as 1939, in advance of the Republican convention that nominated Wendell Willkie. Dewey believed it was his destiny to be president. "It is written in the stars," he said privately. That it was written in the polls as well also carried enormous weight with him. For, unlike Truman, Dewey took such samplings with utmost seriousness. He was the first presidential candidate to have his own polling unit. On several major issues, Dewey, as a liberal Republican, held the same or very similar views as Truman. Dewey backed aid to Greece. He supported the Marshall Plan. He believed in a strong military defense, including universal military training. He was for recognition of Israel. He supported the Berlin airlift and wanted further progress made in civil rights. As he and his advisors saw things, the real struggle waited beyond November, not with the Democrats in Congress, but with Taft, whom Dewey intensely disliked. On more than one occasion, Dewey had been heard to say that the Ohio senator should have carnal relations with himself. The dominating strategy of the Dewey campaign, to say as little as possible, was Dewey's own. "When you're leading, don't talk," he would tell the Republican politicians who came aboard his train. The Dewey High Command, however, had more influence than did the people around Truman. They included campaign manager Herbert Brownell, Jr., whose headquarters were in Washington but who talked to Dewey every night by phone, Paul Lockwood, Dewey's veteran executive assistant, and Elliot Bell, an old friend who wrote speeches and served as unofficial chief of staff on the train. These were able, experienced men. Brownell had been Dewey's campaign manager the last time, as well as chairman of the Republican Party. Lockwood had been with Dewey since his days as district attorney. Elliot Bell, a former financial writer for the New York Times, had managed Dewey's two triumphant campaigns for governor. And they all agreed. The campaign was going fine. Nor had other Republican politicians objected thus far. "We always asked them what our strategy should be," remembered Bell, "and they all said that as matters stood, Dewey was in, and the thing to do was not stir up too much controversy and run the risk of losing votes." The consensus was that Dewey would have done better in 1944 had he not gone on the attack as he did. So, why repeat the mistake? "The tone of his campaign was set," wrote Time approvingly. Time, like its sister publication Life, having concluded that Dewey was as good as elected. The real concern among the Dewey staff, reported Time, was over what Truman might do between now and January to upset things, and particularly in the field of foreign policy. The responsibilities of power already weighed on them so heavily that a newsman inquired blandly, "How long is Dewey going to tolerate Truman's interference in the government?" Dewey, said Life, would keep his composure no matter how much his rival taunted, teased, and dared him to come out in the alley and scrap. Dewey himself remarked that he would never get down in the gutter with Truman. He would have preferred a more worthy opponent. In the seclusion of his private car, Dewey wondered aloud, "Isn't it harder in politics to defeat a fool, say, than an abler man?" To help guarantee a Dewey victory, J. Edgar Hoover was secretly supplying him with all the information the FBI could provide. Dewey and Hoover were old friends and got along well. Hoover had put the resources of the Bureau at Dewey's disposal months before, in the expectation that when Dewey became president, he would name Hoover as his attorney general. "The FBI helped Dewey during the campaign itself by giving him everything we had that could hurt Truman, though there wasn't much," remembered an assistant to Hoover, William C. Sullivan, who was one of those assigned to cull the files. "We resurrected the president's former association with Jim Pendergast and tried to create the impression that Truman was too ignorant to deal with the emerging communist threat. We even prepared studies for Dewey which were released under his name, as if he and his staff had done the work. No one in the Bureau gave Truman any chance of winning." Only on the issue of communists in government was Dewey willing to taunt Truman. "I suggest you elect an administration that simply won't appoint them in the first place," Dewey said at one stop after another, the line always drawing applause. In Los Angeles, at the Hollywood Bowl, flanked on stage by Republican movie stars Gary Cooper, Jeanette MacDonald, and Ginger Rogers, who came from Independence, Missouri, Dewey described communism on the march. "The tragic fact is that too often our own government seems so far to have lost faith in our system of free opportunity as to encourage this communist advance, not hinder it. Communists and fellow travelers have risen to positions of trust in our government, and yet the head of our own government called the exposure of communists in our government a red herring." Dewey did not try to inflame crowd passions. He opposed outlawing communists. "We'll have no thought police," he said. Still, the charge that the government was coddling communists, a charge that had been injected into the campaign by the House Un-American Activities Committee, would be made again and again at nearly every stop. Joseph Alsop described the typical Dewey speech as over-rehearsed and a trifle chilling. Marquis Childs warned in his column that in the very expertness of his campaign, Dewey might be laying up future trouble for himself. Privately, among the Dewey people, there was an increasing uneasiness over the size of the crowds, which, as time conceded, were good, but no more than good. At Salt Lake City, Dewey, like Truman, filled the Mormon tabernacle to overflowing. But the turnout along the streets had been nothing like that for Truman. "We hit Salt Lake City about 5 p.m., Elliot Bell would recall. "I was struck by the fact that there were very few people on the sidewalks, and a good many people walking hardly bothered to look at the motorcade." "Then we went into Texas, and everybody said Texas was going to be cold to the president," Truman would later tell a crowd in Neosho, Missouri, recounting his latest adventures. "And the first city we stopped in was El Paso, and everybody in El Paso was down at the station. The chief of police said he estimated the crowd at 25,000. Then we went over and had breakfast with John Garner, former vice president, a good friend of mine, and he gave me a breakfast to write home about. We had chicken and white-winged dove, and we had ham and bacon and scrambled eggs and hot biscuits and I don't know what all. And the governor of Texas met me there, as did Sam Rayburn, and we went across Texas, and I must have seen a million people in Texas." Pounding his way across Texas, Truman had seemed to gather strength by the hour and give more of himself to the campaign with every stop. He was fighting for his political life and having a grand time at it.
"He is good on the back of a train because he is one of the folks," said Sam Rayburn. "He smiles with them and not at them, laughs with them and not at them."
With the rest of the Old South in revolt over his stand on civil rights, Truman had to hold on to Texas and its 23 electoral votes. Yet racial bias ran strong in Texas. Segregation, poll taxes, outright race hatred. In Texas, he was in Dixiecrat territory for the first time, which was why a cold reception had been assumed. There had even been rumors of threats on his life, of Dixiecrats claiming they'd shoot Truman, that no good son of a bitch and his civil rights. It was the first time a Democratic nominee for the presidency had ever found it necessary to court Texas, and banking on friendships with such long-standing powerful Democrats as Rayburn and Garner, Truman had decided to make it the most strenuous campaign ever waged there by a non-Texan. A high point was the breakfast put on by Cactus Jack Garner at Uvalde, which reporters discovered to their surprise was a tree-shaded town with neat green lawns and no sign of anything remotely like cactus. Served on the glass-enclosed porch of Garner's big, buff-colored brick house, the breakfast was the best he had had in 40 years, Truman later told the delighted crowd outside. 10,000 people and a high school band had been at the Uvalde station to greet him at 6:50 that morning. Now several thousand cheered as he stood on the front porch with Garner, Rayburn, and Governor Buford Jester, none of whom was known for his devotion to civil rights. Jester, not long before, had called Truman's civil rights program a stab in the back. John Garner and he had been friends a long, long time, and they were going to be friends as long as they lived, Truman said. "I'm coming back for another visit sometime. I fished around for another invitation and got it." Old friendships, old loyalties would hold, in other words, not only now for the sake of politics, but later, too, whatever changes were in the wind. The crowd understood what he meant, and the crowd applauded. So pleased was Bess Truman by the warmth of the reception that she broke precedent and stepped forward to the microphone to say thank you, proving thereby, beyond all doubt, reported Robert Donovan in the New York Herald Tribune, what an extraordinary occasion it was. At San Antonio later the same day, Sunday, September 26th, an estimated 200,000 people filled the streets. And at a dinner that night at the Gunter Hotel, speaking spontaneously and simply of his feeling for people and his wish for peace, Truman achieved what Jonathan Daniels called an eloquence close to presidential poetry. "Our government is made up of the people. You are the government. I am only your hired servant. I am the chief executive of the greatest nation in the world, the highest honor that can ever come to a man on earth. But I am the servant of the people of the United States. They are not my servants. I can't order you around or send you to labor camps or have your heads cut off if you don't agree with me politically. We don't believe in that. I believe that if we ourselves try to live as we should, and if we continue to work for peace in this world, and as the old Puritan said, keep your bullets bright and your powder dry, eventually we will get peace in this world, because that is the only way we can survive with the modern inventions under which we live. We have got to harness these inventions for the welfare of man instead of his destruction. That is what I am interested in. That is what I am working for. That is much more important than whether I am President of the United States." "Truman Gains Texas Votes by Human Touch Method," read the headline in the San Antonio Express. When a reporter for the Express polled the correspondents on board the train, he found nearly all now thought Truman had at least a fighting chance. In not quite 4 days in Texas, he made 24 stops, spoke 25 times. He had perfect weather and enthusiastic crowds the whole way. Monday, September 27th, the biggest day, began with a rear platform talk at San Marcos at 6:40 in the morning. As the day wore on, he spoke at Austin, Georgetown, Temple, Waco, Hillsboro, Fort Worth, Grand Prairie, Dallas, Greenville, and the little rail stop of Bells, where he told the crowd, "I'm going over to Bonham and make the speech. It's only 12 miles. Why don't you just get in the car and come on over to Bonham, and I will give the Republicans the gun over there. I think you will like it." The Bonham speech, last of the day, was carried by radio nationwide. On board with him through the day were Rayburn, Governor Jester, and Congressman Lyndon Johnson, candidate for the Senate, who had just been certified by the Democratic State Convention as having defeated his rival in the primary, former Governor Coke Stevenson, by a total of 87 votes out of roughly 1 million cast. At Waco, a boy waved a Confederate flag, and there were scattered boos from the crowd when Truman shook hands with a black woman. Otherwise, all was harmonious. But then, neither did he mention civil rights. At Rebel Stadium in Dallas, where authorities quietly did away with segregation for the day and blacks and whites were mingled in the cheering crowd as never before, Truman, for the first time, hit hard at the Republicans for the hypocrisy of their high-level campaign, the Dewey speeches. "So in making their speeches, they put them on a very high level, so high they are above discussing the specific and serious problems which confront the people. Republican candidates are apparently trying to sing the American voters to sleep with a lullaby about unity. They want the kind of unity that benefits the National Association of Manufacturers, the real estate trusts, the selfish interests. They don't want unity. They want surrender. And I am here to tell you people that I will not surrender." Bonham, in the fertile Blackland Prairie, was Sam Rayburn's hometown. And at Bonham, Truman went after Dewey again, saying Republican unity meant unity of the Tafts and the Martins of Congress. Unity in giving tax relief to the rich. Unity in letting prices go sky high. Unity in whittling away all the benefits of the New Deal. Was that really what they wanted, he asked the crowd. Some things are worth fighting for. We must fight isolationists and reactionaries, the profiteers and the privileged class. Our primary concern is for the little fellow. We think the big boys have always done very well taking care of themselves. It is the business of government to see that the little fellow gets a square deal. Ask Sam Rayburn how many of the big money boys helped when he was sweating blood to get electricity for farmers and the people in small towns. It was all language his audiences understood. He was truly, as Rayburn said, one of the folks, and they let him know how much they approved. At a reception later, at Rayburn's white frame house west of town, hundreds of people waited in a long line across the front lawn. "They came in droves and kept coming," remembered Margaret. When Truman's Secret Service detail, worried for his safety, refused to let him stand in the receiving line unless the names of all the guests were provided, Rayburn exploded. "I know every man, woman, and child here." They were all his friends, every one, Rayburn said. He would vouch for them personally. So, while Truman stood at the door shaking hands and sipping now and then on a surreptitious bourbon and water, Rayburn called out each name. But then Rayburn exclaimed to the governor,
"Shut the door, Buford. They're coming by twice."
For the Republicans, money was never a problem. Talk of the big money behind Dewey was another sign supposedly of just how far out in front Dewey was, how certain his victory, on the theory that big money never followed a loser. But to find backing for Truman was nearly impossible. At small White House receptions for Democrats that spring and summer, Truman himself had had to ask for financial help, something he detested, just to get his campaign underway. At one such gathering in the Red Room in early September, he had stood on a chair to say, in effect, that while he knew most people thought he was going to lose, he thought the President of the United States should have sufficient funds to take his case to the people, but that, as things were, he could not do that. There was no money to buy radio time. One of the most important parts of his speech in Detroit on Labor Day had to be cut, he said, because of insufficient funds to stay on the air. Now there was not money enough to get the train out of Union Station. His plea, reportedly, produced over $100,000. When Truman asked Bernard Baruch to serve on the Finance Committee, Baruch refused, saying it was not his policy to play so partisan a role, an answer that infuriated Truman, who in sharp reply wrote, "A great many honors have passed your way, and it seems when the going is rough it is a one-way street." Baruch, his pride hurt, spoke of the president as a rude, ignorant, uncouth man. Others, too, turned him down, until finally he named for financial chairman Lewis A. Johnson of Clarksburg, West Virginia, a former commander of the American Legion and assistant secretary of war, who had headed the Finance Committee of the Democratic Party from 1936 to 1940. Johnson was a looming, bald-headed, headstrong corporation lawyer and millionaire who stood over 6 feet tall and weighed 250 pounds. A subject of controversy in the past, he would be again in time to come, to Truman's regret. But he took the job now when nobody else would, and he achieved amazing results, given the fact that no one other than Truman thought the ticket had the slightest chance. Averill Harriman and Will Clayton were among the larger contributors. Harriman gave $5,000, Clayton $9,000. Others included Stuart Symington, David Dubinsky of the International Lady Garment Workers, Milton S. Kronheim, Sr., who controlled the wholesale liquor business in Washington, Jacob Blaustein, president of the American Jewish Committee, William Hellas, a Louisiana oil man known as the Golden Greek, who had been Governor Earl Long's biggest money backer, Cornelius Vanderbilt Whitney, and Pearl Mesta, the Washington hostess who came on board the Truman train at Gainesville, Texas, for the ride across Oklahoma, where her first husband had made a fortune in oil. Floyd B. Odlum, the head of Atlas Corporation, a Wall Street investment company, put in $3,000, then rounded up another $20,000 from his associates. But the largest contribution seems to have come from Truman's old Kansas City friend Tom Evans, the drugstore king, who, after giving $3,000 himself, raised some $100,000 more in the Middle West. As the train headed across Oklahoma, the weather remained ideal. Truman, in fine fettle, spent much of the time out on the back platform waving at people as he sped along. If he was worried about campaign funds or anything else, no one would have known it. During a stop at Ardmore, having expressed his admiration for the Palomino horse of a cowboy who met the train, Truman examined the animal's mouth and declared it was 6 years old.
"Correct," exclaimed the delighted cowboy, and the story appeared across the country. "Truman gets right dope from horse's mouth."
The crowd at Ardmore was somewhere near 40,000, more even, it was said, than for Gene Autry. At remote stations where no stops were scheduled, people waited just to see the train go through. At Paul's Valley, Truman asked if it was true they grew taller corn than in Iowa, and 5,000 people happily roared yes. "Hello, Harry," came shouts from the throng at Norman. At Oklahoma City, 100,000 turned out. 20,000 were at the state fairgrounds for his speech. He had chosen Oklahoma as the time and place to answer Republican charges of communism in government, and he was strictly on the offensive. Such Republican tactics were only a smokescreen to hide their failure to deal with housing, price controls, education, real problems. His own loyalty program, he claimed, had proven the loyalty of 99.7% of all federal workers. It was not Republican talk that checked the communist tide, but programs like the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan, and that was a plain and unanswerable fact. The government was not endangered by communist infiltration. Publicity-seeking, electioneering Republicans with their irresponsible charges were doing more to damage national security than to strengthen it. The speech was considered so important that for the first time the Democratic National Committee had dipped into its slim resources to pay for nationwide radio time. But by then, the money had run out. There was not enough even to move the train out of the station. The crisis was resolved when Governor Roy J. Turner of Oklahoma and a businessman from Shawnee, W. Elmer Harbor, organized an emergency collection party on board the Ferdinand Magellan and raised enough contributions, a substantial sum, to keep the train rolling for another several weeks. But even so, remembered Charlie Ross, the campaign was never more than one jump ahead of the sheriff. The day following, Wednesday, September 29th, was one of the biggest of the campaign. At Eufaula, Oklahoma, Truman gave his 100th speech. Before the day ended, he spoke 16 times. There were crowds at Shawnee, Seminole, Wawoka, Muskogee, tremendous crowds at Tulsa. Crossing into Missouri, Truman told the throng at Neosho that he had already talked to 500,000 people that day, an understandable overstatement given all he had seen. And so it went the rest of the journey through Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, and West Virginia. At Mount Vernon, Illinois, leaving his train to travel by motorcade, he stumped the downstate mining country for 140 miles, through five counties that had not gone Democratic in 50 years. "Mr. Truman," reported the New York Times, "was the first chief executive to campaign in southern Illinois, and the people turned out by the thousands, breaking through police lines, swarming around and through the procession of cars, and yelling a noisy greeting." With his headlong lambasting of Wall Street and the special interests, the constant hearkening to grim memories of the Depression, he sounded often as if he were running against Herbert Hoover. But at Carbondale, the sixth of nine stops in southern Illinois, he talked as he had not until now of the post-war era, of the history he himself felt responsible for and proud of, knowing how many in his audience remembered how differently things had gone after the first war. A Democratic administration, working with a Democratic Congress, had seen to a swift reconversion in 1945, not only avoiding a post-war recession, but achieving a peak of more jobs, a higher civilization, and better standards of living than ever before. There is nothing like that in the history of the world after a great war. Bear that in mind. Not very much has been said about that, but we had no riots and no bloodshed. We didn't have people crying for jobs. We didn't have farmers marching on Washington. We didn't have returning soldiers marching on Washington because we took care of them in educational institutions and absorbing them back into the economy of the country without a debacle. We enacted the Employment Act of 1946, pledging all our resources and efforts to the maintenance of prosperity. We brought the United States to a position of unquestioned leadership in world affairs. Don't let anybody tell you anything different. A warm reception in Kentucky had been anticipated, if for no other reason than Alvin Barkley's presence on the ticket. But the crowds there surpassed all predictions. Truman was never more human, reported the Louisville Courier-Journal. He got down to earth and talked the language of the people. At Shelbyville, where a banner stretched in front of a wood-frame depot said, "Welcome home, President Truman and family, grandchildren of Shelby County," he talked of his grandfather, who had been married there. At Lexington, heart of the bluegrass horse country, he reminded everyone that it didn't matter which horse was ahead or behind at any given moment in the race, it was the horse ahead at the finish that counted. To the several thousand gathered on the tracks at Moorhead, Kentucky, pressing as close as possible to the rear platform of his car, he left no doubt what he expected of them. "Now, whatever you do, go to the polls early on election day and don't waste any time. Just take that ticket and vote the Democratic ticket straight down the line, and you will be helping your country and helping yourselves. You will not only be voting for me, but you will be voting for yourselves and your best interests. And I believe that is exactly what you are going to do." At Montgomery, West Virginia, the final stop at 10:45 that night, Truman was so stunned by the size of the turnout at such an hour that before beginning his remarks, he asked the photographers to turn their cameras around and take a picture of the people. That was the real news to show the country, he said. But what to make of the phenomenon of the Truman crowds? Most correspondents attributed it to ordinary curiosity.